topic this morning is a little bit away from the area where we've been doing most of our work this weekend, that is the area of biological evolution, and yet I think it is relevant certainly to the question of origins, and that's the problem of inanimate design in nature, design in the inanimate part of nature, if you like. In the history of Christian evidences, design has certainly had an important part to play. Taking a cue, I think, from the passages we looked at in Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, and Romans 1, the remark about men being without excuse, because that which may be known of God is clearly seen in the things he's made. Christian theologians and others over the centuries have structured arguments from design in nature to a designer behind nature. Probably the classical argument from design is that put together by William Paley, right at the beginning of the 19th century, 1802, in his book Natural Theology, which he compares the idea of design in living things to the kind of design we find in a fine watch, and suggests just as we find in a watch, the parts are very carefully contrived to work together. So the contrivance of parts working together in living animals and such point to a designer. The work was expanded even somewhat by a grant in the 1830s by the Earl Bridgewater that developed eventually into a series of 12 volumes published, written by Thomas Chalmers and a number of others called the Bridgewater Treatises. And here, the persons doing the writing were actually scientists in various fields, and they were looking at design in their particular fields. It's been generally felt in our own culture that the argument from design was demolished by Darwin and others in the production of the theory of evolution. Basically, the idea was that instead of a designer, there are random changes taking place in living things. And the Grim Reaper, we might say, is the designer. That is, the animals which die, or the plants which die without reproducing, they are the less fit ones. And the ones that reproduce, and the ones that reproduce more effective progeny who are able to outnumber the others and such, those are the ones who are more fit. And you have a selection mechanism which many, many biologists believe that is the non-random part of evolution. And it works so strongly that it produces new organs, functioning systems of often hundreds or thousands of parts working together, that it produces optimization of various organs so that they're designed to, perhaps like a blood platelet, to receive, have the maximum surface area for the particular volume that they have and such. And all of these are ascribed to natural selection. The book I've read most recently that comes along very strongly in this direction is Richard Dawkins' The Blind Watchmaker. And you want a book that that tries to push for all its worth neo-Darwinian evolution as against punctuated equilibrium, and natural selection as an adequate explanation for all the design we have in nature. Dawkins' work certainly falls in that category. I suggest here, however, that Darwin's solution to design in nature, which has some serious problems, which we've been investigating already this weekend, doesn't really solve the problem of design in inanimate nature, where you haven't got reproduction, where you haven't got natural selection and such. And it's that area we'd like to look at for a few minutes this morning. The problem of design in inanimate nature. I've structured my talk here under three headings. They are not mutually exclusive nor jointly exhaustive, but they all start with an R by the clever device of putting right in the front of each one of them. Work it right, you can get these things to happen. It seems to me that we have the right chemistry, and we'll have to ask right for what. We've got the right environment, and we've got the right universe. And the answer for what is, of course, we don't know for what, but we can give some samples of for what. It's the right chemistry, the right environment, and the right universe for life, and even for intelligent life to exist. We'll need to come back to responses to this particular evidence, and that we'll look at lastly. Picking out right, in discussing right chemistry, I just picked out three things. All of them are important. There are probably dozens and dozens of other things in the area of chemistry that are, well, for life, we could probably say equally important, because if you don't have it, you don't have it, okay? If you don't have the one, you don't have the other. But I think most people would grant at least that water and carbon are quite crucial for any kind of life we know about, and phosphorus at least for the animal life. Talk about carbon just a little bit. Carbon is one of several elements that will form chains. That is, there's a way in which the carbon will link together to other carbons and make, therefore, rather bigger molecules than you typically get with other types of elements. Some elements make no molecules, or you have to really beat on them to make molecules. The noble elements, as they're called, is a better name than that, but that's the only one that comes to mind at the moment. Helium, argon, xenon, etc. Other elements make some fairly simple compounds in which maybe one or two of the of that element come up and then some other things link onto it. Carbon, however, makes huge chains, as one writer says, chains of almost unlimited length. And there apparently is nothing that's quite like that. Silicon certainly makes some link chains. You can get some fairly substantial chains there. But the carbon, the only one we know that makes chains of almost unlimited length. If you ask ourselves where carbon comes from, as creationists we would say, well, it comes from God. But we want to ask the more intermediate question, how did God choose to produce carbon? Did he say, let there be carbon? Zap, and there was carbon. Did he work some other way? The evidence at the moment, I'm operating off an old Earth position here, the evidence at the moment would indicate that God caused carbon to be formed inside stars. That's the process that we have. The best we can tell from the universe now is that there wasn't much else but hydrogen, helium, deuterium, and maybe a few other very light elements in very small quantities at the time that you get far enough away from the Big Bang for elements to exist. And that the heavier elements, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, iron, etc., all the way up to uranium and such, they're produced inside stars. A star is a thermonuclear reactor. It uses a process like fusion, which is the process that is now really being worked on in the laboratories, at least in the first world, as the energy source we hope to have for the next century. Fusion takes light elements, and the best one to take is hydrogen, and convert them to slightly heavier elements, that particular reaction, hydrogen, helium, and you extract, I think, around 2 or 3% of the mass energy out of the hydrogen to convert it to helium, and that's way bigger than you do even for fission, the sort of technique used in atom bombs and used in nuclear power plants today. And it's astronomically bigger than the energy you get out of chemical reactions. Well, stars, when they go through their life cycle, they start out, first of all, after they have collapsed down to the level where the nuclear reactions come on, they go down to what's called the main sequence, and their process inside is burning hydrogen into helium. That is, transmuting the element hydrogen into the element helium. You get a fair bit of energy out of it, and such. That process goes on in stars that we call main sequence stars, but eventually you get the place where the core of the star is used up, all of the available hydrogen. There's more hydrogen outside, in the outer part of the star, but not in where the temperature is high enough for the reaction to take place. And at that point, star starts to collapse again because there's no energy source throwing out enough heat to produce enough pressure to keep the thing from collapsing. Its gravity begins to collapse. The next stage, then, is that in which some new hydrogen would come in and begin a thin hydrogen-burning shell outside of the core. But the core itself continues to collapse until a temperature goes from about 10 million, which is the temperature at which the hydrogen reaction goes on, up to about 100 million. And there, the helium begins now to fuse. And that reaction is going to produce carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and such. And so that's the next step. And that step is a step that's taking place in the stars we call red giants. The inner part has collapsed. This new reaction has come on at a 10 times higher temperature. Some things have happened that cause the outer envelope to get a lot bigger, and that's how you get the redder and the giantish features of it. I don't want to wander around too much talking about that. But the upshot is that inside the star you now produce slightly heavier elements, and then the core will collapse some more after all the helium is used up. Not only use up faster because there's less of it and because there's less energy produced in the reaction, and then you go on to start producing heavier and heavier elements up towards what would be a stable element around iron. Iron is the most stable, nuclear-wise, of the elements, and you begin to get a collection of elements around iron in the very innermost core of the star. Finally, when you get through there, you get more energy. energy source from the inner part of the star, and the inner part of the star now begins to collapse catastrophically. And stars that are big enough will collapse. Well, maybe say the star starts to collapse again. Small stars will collapse to a stable state that we call white dwarfs. Larger stars collapse catastrophically, and they will eventually blow a good piece of the star all over the neighborhood out for many light years around the star. And in doing that, they blow out the carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, iron, etc., all of that. And so we have in our universe, as we can now observe it, we have stars we might call first-generation stars, stars in which there was very little heavy elements at all in their formation. They have a little different spectrum. We call them, because of some dumb historical reasons, population 2 stars. And we have second-generation stars or third-generation stars or whatever, which have heavy elements in their outer atmosphere, meaning they formed after there are heavy elements around in the universe for them to pick up, and because of the same dumb historical thing, we call them population 1 stars. So I won't go into all that. The upshot of all of this is carbon is formed inside stars, like with nitrogen, oxygen, iron, phosphorus, and all of these sort of things. We'll come back to the fact that certain things have to be just right to get this stuff scattered around the universe, but rather interesting feature, carbon absolutely necessary for life, at least of any kind of life we know anything about. Science fiction writers, of course, know all about silicon life and various other sort of things, but nobody's ever, one, found any, or even made any really good plausibility arguments that something like that will really can really carry life. One of the striking things about carbon, though, is that were it not for two features that, as far as we could tell, would be think of as arbitrary, something about the energy levels in the nucleus of carbon, energy levels in the nucleus of oxygen. If it weren't for these things being just right, carbon would be a rare element. What we have now is that hydrogen is a very common element, say frequency up here in a list of the elements and their frequencies found in the universe. Helium, it's up almost 80%. Helium's down here about 20%. Everything else together is about 1%. But if you look at it, the stuff between helium and carbon is very low, and you get kind of a peak at carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and it falls off again rather rapidly on the other side, and it's because of the commonality of carbon that we've got lots of it available for living things. However, inside a star, the temperature phenomena when you're converting helium, helium into the heavier elements, etc., the temperatures are just right that the event that you have to have, having three heliums combined together to get a carbon. Carbon's a result of a triple collision. That is normally something extremely rare, but two of the heliums at those kind of temperatures stick together for a long time, and so they make what's called a resonance phenomenon. And the helium is able to stick together for a long time at just those temperatures, and the result is you get a lot of carbon formed. However, there's also reactions in which you would pick up another helium and you'd get oxygen form out of the carbon. And it turns out the energy level for that is the energy level for that is just above the energy level you need. You don't get a resonance, and so you don't lose your carbon over to oxygen very easily. You have a resonance that makes carbon form a lot more easily than you'd otherwise expect. Then you have another resonance to form oxygen that's just a little higher, and you don't get it. And the result is that you have a lot more carbon than you would expect. It's reported. I have never seen it. I've never seen it in print from Fred Hoyle. But when Fred Hoyle was working on the question of the origin of the elements, a project he was rather important in, he noticed these two resonances, and he must have commented to someone, if the story's true, that nothing ever shook his atheism like seeing those two resonances. They're just right. They're just a little bit different, just a few percent different, either one. You'd either have very little hydrogen and carbon formed, or the carbon formed would all drain off into oxygen and you'd have very little left. It'd still be a rare element in either case, but the balance of these two resonances is just right. There's a remark about it in Hoyle's book, Galaxy, Nuclei, and Quasars, but not with the exciting, and nothing ever shook my atheism like. He was still atheist when he wrote that particular work. Owen Gingrich has written a little article in a book called by Roland Fry called Is God a Creationist? Fry's interest now. But Gingrich's article, rather nice, went in there on this subject, and he mentions that incident with Hoyle. It is of some interest that Hoyle has moved from atheism to some kind of theism over the last 20-some years. When I was in grad school, he was definitely one of the big-gun atheists in the astrophysical realm, and has definitely moved over since that time. And certainly this may have moved him that way some. I think his work on the origin of life moved him over there much more. He's much more responsible. So carbon itself, something crucially needed, very rare in the universe except for the exact placement of these two resonances. They move just a couple percent, and you would have very little carbon. No, it's a common element because of the way they are. Look over a moment at phosphorus. The element phosphorus forms a number of compounds which are quite unusual in that they can store large amounts of energy, your ATP, ADB, ADP, I believe it is. Better talk to Bloom over here, a biophysicist, to check out some of these things. But the transition back and forth there is a way of storing large amounts of energy in molecules, and it really is what allows animals to be able to do the things they do versus plants doing what they do. In spite of science fiction writers, again, with plants that reach out and grab people, etc., C.S. Lewis has been known to write about those kind of plants, too. We don't have much in that direction in the plant world. Nobody at the moment has had to fight off Venus fly traps or anything like that. They don't grow big enough, move fast enough, etc., for being danger to humans. They're obviously danger to flies. But part of the reason is that plants really don't react to the environment quite the way animals do. And one reason animals do is that they've got an energy source that allows them, one, to be movable. They are themselves portable, and they can move around rather rapidly. Only element that has this property, phosphorus. I want to spend a little more time on water. Water is rather interesting. We don't know of any kind of life that's based on anything other than water. I'm talking about life in this universe, obviously. I'm not talking about angels and God and such. Okay. Water is rather interesting for several reasons. First of all, it's a small molecule, and by just working out the dynamics of what small molecules do at room temperature, it'll all be a gas. And we'd be in kind of bad shape if it were a gas at room temperature, because we would be 80% gas instead of 80% water. And that would be problematic in itself. And storing the stuff and drinking the stuff and all of that would be much more complicated. I won't wander into that. It's not a gas at room temperature, because water has a tendency to form kind of a semi-polymer at room temperature. Two or three waters kind of get together, and that increases their mass enough that they're liquid at room temperature instead. And so water functions, as I'll mention down here, as a universal solvent and such, which is rather crucial. And it does that at the kind of temperature we're talking about because of this polymer formation. And yet, if when water evaporated, it still was polymeric, so that it formed gas molecules of two or three waters hooked together, it would kind of sit down here near the surface, like carbon dioxide does, and you got enough of that sitting around. It was thick enough, you couldn't breathe. Water vapor, which doesn't do the things that oxygen is supposed to do. And having gas sitting around on the surface that you can't breathe can be very difficult. This incident happened just in the last year over in a lake in Africa. Seems to be a sample of that. A lake turned over. By that, I mean water in the bottom of the top and vice versa. Anyway, somehow emitted a large amount of carbon dioxide in this valley, and hundreds of people died. They were wondering whether it was some kind of toxic gas at first. No, it's not toxic gas. It's carbon dioxide. But carbon dioxide instead of oxygen puts you in bad shape, toxic or not. So that's a sample, I think, of the kind of danger you would have if water stayed polymeric when it was in its gaseous state. It does not. So, in fact, it becomes lighter than air, disperses through the air rather nicely, and we have pretty cool stuff. So just that little feature is rather interesting about water, but there are several others as well. Water is often called the universal solvent. As you know, it is not the universal solvent. You always get spots on your clothes that won't wash out with water, and you can't even get them out with soap and such. But it is really a very wide range of things can be dissolved by water. And many more things can be dissolved by water if you're willing to wait geological ages instead of a half an hour to get that shirt so it looks good so you can wear it somewhere. And the result is that water becomes, in fact, the material that is used inside trees to transmit nutrients up from the roots. It's the stuff that's used inside people to move the blood around and it's the stuff that's used inside cells to move to support the molecules as they move around. Universal solvent. The reason it functions well as a solvent is it's a polar molecule. It's an H and two O's. Two H's and an O. Here a minute. Two H's and an O. And instead of being on a nice straight line, they're at an angle like this. And the result is one end of the molecule has a slightly negative charge, positive charge, and it functions as an excellent solvent. Anything else that's a comparable solvent that we know of in nature is really very corrosive and quite unfortunate for various types of plants and animals. So a second feature of water that's very, very crucial. A third feature of water that's very helpful is it has an unusually high heat capacity. That is, ability to store heat, we'll call it that. Water has to have a fair amount of heat added to raise a given amount of it 1 degree centigrade, whereas most other materials need less of it to raise it 1 degree centigrade. Or, on the other hand, as they cool, they take more cooling to lower the temperature. Result is, water works very nicely as a temperature modifier, a temperature, maybe a ballast would be a better term, keeping the temperature from varying drastically. You can actually see that effect rather strongly right here at Hardy Cedars, where the temperature is much more moderate here than they are on land just a few miles over here. When you come down here in the winter, you feel it's warmer over here in general because of the water. And when you come down here in the summer, you'll find it's cooler here. Very noticeable in the summer when I've been down here more frequently that you come off the island and you land about 2 to 3 miles in temperature. It's very noticeable. That is certainly quite crucial. A high heat capacity. A fourth feature that's rather important regarding water is the fact that it expands on freezing. I believe it was Pete Perry yesterday that was discussing the problem of having ammonia and freezing and sinking to the bottom. Or was that with Dave Bosser? Yeah. If we had life based on some other liquid, virtually everything else, when it freezes, condenses and therefore would drop to the bottom, and you freeze up your ocean solid from bottom to top, whereas water rises, expands, forms an insulating layer, and keeps the water from freezing up. So oceans and ponds as well are kept from freezing. Obviously rather crucial when you live in an environment where the temperature does drop below the freezing point of water, as it does in many places on Earth during the winter. So water has a rather striking set of features that, if removed any of them, would really make a very big difference on how well life could function, and several of them I think would be quite fatal, if you like, and this water has got all of those. There are a number of other things of this sort. I've not worked in the area myself much. I wouldn't be surprised to see some of them in the work there that Bosser was mentioning on the anthropic cosmological principle, discussion of the way in which chemistry works together. Much of this material has been known since the turn of the century. Work was written then, one of the few works on inanimate design written between the Bridgewater treatises and just in the last few years, a work called Fitness of the Environment. We're going to move on, in fact, to the environment question, but much of what we're going to discuss regarding environment is fairly recent information that has been learned in the last generation or even in the last few years. Not only is the chemistry found throughout the universe, of course, just right so that it can support a very complicated system we call life, but the environment on the Earth is just right, and this seems to be something that is quite rare in the universe. As suggested before, we have perhaps 100 to 400 billion stars in our galaxy. That is about 10 to the 12th, yeah, let's make it 11th, 10 to the 11th stars in our galaxy, and we've got perhaps 10 to the 9th to 10 to the 11th galaxies within the visible universe. We don't know how much universe there is beside that. And it is possible that the average star has got planets around it. I think most people feel that. So, or at least if it's a single star as opposed to multiple stars, there's probably planets around it. And many biologists, exobiologists like Sagan, are desirous of saying, well, there's probably a nice Earth-like planet around each of those. That is certainly not true. And the reason it's not true is there are too many things that have to be just right. I list several of them here. We'll talk about some of them. First thing's the temperature. Unless we have good reason to believe that there's a whole other chemistry from which life can be produced, as I say, although science fiction writers and occasionally scientists would like to think silicon might work, nobody, in fact, has any definite evidence would seem to have some rather serious limitations. So we're pretty well stuck with carbon, and carbon is going to look like it's going to have to be operated with water as it's a solvent and other things. You need to be in a temperature place where the water will be liquid, what we call a habitable zone around a star. Habitable zone would be a zone in which the temperature on an average planet in that region, average meaning not too much atmosphere to make it too much hotter or too little atmosphere to or some other process making it colder, the temperature would be right for water to be in the liquid phase. You can see that our environment's pretty good in that direction. We live on the planet Earth. We've got about two-thirds of the surface covered with about a three-mile average of water. Or if we spread it out over the whole surface, we've got a two-mile depth of water, a lot of water. Most of it's liquid. But in fact, we live on a planet where we've got the whole range from vapor form in the atmosphere, temperatures in a few places that vaporize water around volcanoes, many, many places where water will freeze, Antarctica, Arctic area, all year, the high mountains, even the equator, and in the temperate zones in the winter, we've got freezing water. So probably you're only going to have about one planet per planetary system that is going to be in the right place. So that when you work out the distances, that's probably the case. In our solar system, if you imagine that you can specify the atmosphere and such, you could get Venus or Mars also to be in that right range. But in fact, Venus has got a big atmosphere and then runs way outside of the range. And Mars has got too little atmosphere and tends to stay over on the freezing side all the time. It's estimated the temperature gets around freezing or a little above at noon on the equator in the middle of summer in Mars. So it's kind of right at the edge. So maybe a couple of planets per star would be in good shape on that. However, the next question of water, how much water you've got. The Earth's got a lot of water, though if you actually measure it as percent of the total mass of the planet, it's really not very much. It's just that things have worked out just right that all our water is on that little thin onion skin that represents the surface of the Earth. Earth's about 4,000 miles from the center of the edge, and we've got about 3 miles of water. 2 miles of water if we spread it out. So we've got about 1 in 2,000 volume, if you like, would be a little bigger than that, and you realize that we're a sphere we're talking about, so it's the volume is decreasing to the center. So we've got an awful lot of water because it's all concentrated right at the surface, but Venus and Mars seem to have virtually zilch, even if it is all concentrated surface. We don't know for sure it is. I suspect it is in both of their cases that the processes that brought water to the surface in ours, the heating of radioactive materials inside, the compressive heating, etc., probably drove out the hydrates on Mars and Venus as well as on Earth, but they don't have them. They either lost them over space or never had them. I suspect they lost them one way or another. So that's going to run things down rather substantially. We don't have anything else in the solar system that's got reasonable amounts of water, so probably already you're getting down below one per planetary system when you get to the question of reasonable amount of water. How about the atmosphere? Well, we've got oxygen, and oxygen is perhaps one of maybe two different kinds of elements that might be usable in some kind of reaction that would power things the way oxygen does. And it's our level's right in the right range again. If you had a fair amount less oxygen, you would not have enough for animals to function. Already we know on our planet that the animals can get into trouble on the oxygen direction up in high mountains. Most animals have sense enough to stay away from those areas, but humans don't. And so people trying to climb Everest and stuff are going to get troubles. And in the early interest of aviation, they realize that the flying around in open cockpits is not only cold, but we've got up pretty high, but the airplane engines didn't work that well, and people didn't work that well. And so things have had to be done in that direction. So you can't go down too much. You begin to run into trouble with the animals. You can't go up too much, or you begin to have troubles with plant life burning up very easily. And so we've got kind of a nice range there. The variation is perhaps 10-15%. It's not a bit. It's not as narrow a variation as the kind of variation involved in the question of the location of the two resonances of carbon, but it's still not trivial. And our atmosphere, as far as we can tell, has got enormous amounts of oxygen compared with either Venus or Mars as far as free oxygen is concerned. Would suggest, I think, that plant life is at least one of the things responsible for releasing a lot of this free oxygen as well. So that's got to be just right. Hard to give a judgment on how common that is, but again, we're the one in the solar system that's got that. And may well suggest now that we're well below one planet per system that's going to work right here. The gravity of Earth has to be right, and I give you the ranges here that are problematical. If the gravity of the Earth goes down as low as 1/4 of what it is now, that is going to produce a situation in which there's too little atmospheric pressure, but even if you've got an amount of oxygen, you're not going to get by on animals being able to live. If you double the gravity, the atmosphere will become thick enough that your greenhouse effect becomes too strong, and you begin to get overheating. So we see, for reasons other than gravity, how Venus has a runaway greenhouse effect and really cranks the temperature out beyond what's reasonable. So again, a fairly narrow range. It's very difficult to judge how frequent this would be. This, I think, is going to depend very much on how much material there is in your solar nebula that goes into the sun versus how much is left for the planets, how much of that is in close, and that sort of thing, on whether your planet will be the right size. That also happens to be in the habitable zone. That's the question. And it also happens to have the right amount of water. So we're beginning to get a number of things going together that we're not able to model yet on how frequent those would occur and would not. It's dependent upon the mass, okay? And for a given density, that would depend on the size. Or for a given size, you might be able to get it up by having more dense or less dense material. Wayne. If the gravity is larger, you hold on to more of the gases coming out from inside the Earth, okay? And if it gets big enough, you even hold on to stuff in the original nebula. So your total amount of atmospheric pressure goes up rather substantially, and that then begins to produce a stronger trapping of the radiation coming in. So that basically would be it. Yeah, carbon dioxide is more effective than oxygen. There are other factors involved here besides that. In other words, what chemicals you've actually got in your atmosphere is going to make some difference as well. Larger carbon dioxide would make a larger greenhouse effect. And that's one of the things people are worrying about, is the fossil fuel burning down here producing too much carbon dioxide, and we're going to have a runaway greenhouse effect in the next century or two. The other thing about ozone, you know, your spray cans, etc., destroying ozone is a question of, is it not greenhouse effect, are you going to let ultraviolet in? That's being destroyed now, absorbed now in the upper atmosphere by ozone. If you lose the ozone, that comes all the way down to the surface and such. It's fatal to life. So here we're working on just the twice the gravity with the same composition or the same series of events through which the planet would produce too much of a greenhouse effect, etc. The sun's size is rather important as well, because the stars on the main sequence, that's what our sun is like, and that's what all your other stars that really have any kind of reasonable long lifespans are about. They're the ones burning hydrogen to helium. Those stars, the larger they are, the faster they burn their fuel, the hotter they burn. And so you have up at one end of your spectrum, you have large, hot stars. They call blue giants. And then you go down through whiter, yellower, oranger, redder, and smaller stars all the way as you go down, and longer lives. It's interesting that to get the kind of stuff we need for life that we have on Earth, if the star is only 20% larger than the one we've got, it would have already run through its fuel in this length of time. We're working off an old Earth model here, and we wouldn't be here. Okay? If it were 20% smaller, it'd be in great shape on the fuel, but it wouldn't produce enough ultraviolet to get down to the surface to run in photoelectric, or the photosynthesis. Photoelectric effect, by the way, is a third thing that Einstein did in 1905. Remember who brought that up? Okay. Too little ultraviolet for photosynthesis. So, again, this is a rather narrow band. The size of planets run up to size of stars run up to perhaps 100 times larger than the sun, and down to perhaps 100 times smaller than the sun. That's where you get the smallest objects that will set off thermonuclear fusion inside. The temperature would high enough to run that. But only this range of 20% in either direction is going to be good. You're not going to have enough lifespan for the star. You're going to have a lifespan under 4 billion years. If you've got the star more than 20% larger, more than 20% smaller, you've got no way of plants producing energy. And at least in any kind of life we know about, the plants producing energy are necessary for the animals to give the energy. The bottom animals are operating off the plants. We may not be vegetarians, so we do a fair bit in that direction, but we'd be in bad shape if we didn't eat animals that were at one remove that were vegetarian. So real troubles in that direction. The size of the star has to be about right. This then gets us very quickly into cutting down the number of solar system, the number of planetary systems we're going to be good with. Okay, this little 40% slice here is a very small fraction of the number of stars. The frequency distribution of stars goes up very rapidly as you go to with small stars. And so you're already down now. I haven't got numbers in front of me, but I'm guessing under one-tenth of the million stars would fall in this category of 20% larger and 20% smaller. Question of variation of luminosity is another problem. If the luminosity of the star, the rate at which it turns out energy, the rate at which it shines, is too high, then you got troubles. You can, of course, move the star, move the planet out a little bit and straighten things out, but then you're going to run into the thing running down too fast. If a luminosity is small, you can move in closer, but you don't get the ultraviolet. But now suppose we've got it at our given position, and we ask the question, how much can the luminosity of the star vary without things going wrong? And the answer would be just a few percent. If the temperature of our planet drops a couple percent, we're into ice ages. Goes up a couple percent, you begin to get this greenhouse effect rolling away. I point out something very interesting, though, about the history of the Earth. The sun has already varied too much, if you're just looking at luminosity. There's evidence that the sun's luminosity has varied by about 25% over 4 billion years, and it's way more than could be handled, except that as the sun's luminosity began to rise period that would be, I guess, late Precambrian, early Cambrian period, as the sun's luminosity began to come up, the plants began to thin out the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and the greenhouse effect was turned down. And the balance of those two things kept the actual average temperature very nice and very close to the same value all through there. This, I think, is really very striking, and it is hard to believe that's going to happen in general on a perfect planet otherwise. And I think it's this kind of situation that throws a monkey wrench in the idea that, every star has got planets, or every single star has got planets, let's say. That knocked it down to about a third of them probably already. And every star that's got planets has probably got a planet in the habitable zone. That's probably correct. And that star in the habitable zone is going to be an Earth-sized planet. That's probably incorrect. And it's going to have oxygen on it. That's certainly incorrect, I would think. And it's going to have the right gravity. We don't know whether that's correct or not. And then, of course, getting here the size of the sun, we know that's not going to be every star. That's going to really bring it down rather there drastically at that point. And then we've got this striking thing about variation in luminosity. We hear that in the life of a star, you will have such variations in luminosity. And here, the behavior of the plants in converting carbon dioxide to oxygen thins down the greenhouse effect just right so that the temperature is maintained. I mentioned in our notes in the back here this article by Michael Hart, Habitable Zones About Main Sequence Stars. He deals with the phenomenon of continuously habitable zones. That is, do they stay habitable over the lifespan of the star? And he points out, even after discussing this turndown here of the greenhouse effect, that even with that happening, if the Earth had only been 5% closer to the sun, that wouldn't have happened early enough, and there would have been a runaway greenhouse effect up in the front of the history of the Earth. It would have killed all the planets. And if we'd been only 1% further away from the sun, there would have been a runaway glaciation about 2 billion years ago. Both of those phenomena have what we call positive feedback. That is, if you have a planet that's a little too hot and it boils off some of the water evaporate from the water. Water is a little too strong. Doesn't need to be 100 centigrade. Evaporates more of the water, produces more of your cloud cover and such. You begin to get a strong greenhouse effect rolling, and that heats it up more, and it puts out more, and the greenhouse gets stronger, etc. And that, I think, explains why Venus is, although it's at a distance from the sun, that if it hit our kind of atmosphere, its temperature would be bad, maybe 100, 150 or something. Its temperature is actually 900 because the greenhouse effect, positive feedback, it starts out and gets worse and worse and worse and worse. Positive feedback is named from electronics, and it's for that squeak that you hear when you point a microphone the wrong way and you pick up feedback from the loudspeaker. The little bit of noise in the room goes in the microphone, comes out the loudspeaker, goes in the microphone again, comes out the loudspeaker, amplified, quickly builds up, gets a real big squeak. Positive feedback, we call that. And that's the way greenhouse effects work, and that's the way glaciation works. In glaciation, you have snow one winter. If you got a big winter snow, and maybe it doesn't all melt, there's all that white stuff down there bouncing sunlight back out in space. So you get a little colder down. If you have a worse winter, the next winter, you put some more snow down. You get more bounced back into space, and it goes away in that direction. And the Hart points out that if the Earth had been 1% further away, runaway glaciation, about halfway through Earth's history today, about 2 billion years ago. So notice here we really have a lot of things working together for the right environment, and it suggests that we're going to get a very, very small number for the fraction of planets that might work all of these things just right. So we live in very much the right environment. And yet there's something even more perhaps basic than that, and that's the question of the kind of universe we live in. We need to press on to this quite rapidly here in order to get through our discussion. In our universe, we know of four physical forces. There's some concern to combine these, and some of them do in fact combine at very high temperatures, pressures, the electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear force. There's quite good evidence that they combine at very high temperatures. The strongest force we know of in our universe, natural force, is the nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, strong interaction sometimes above. Much weaker than that, 10 to the third is not a real good approximation, is the electromagnetic force. Weaker than that, the weak nuclear force, and the weakest of the four forces, gravity. Under similar conditions, they have these relative strengths. 1/1000th, 100,000th, and 10 to minus 40, which I don't know the names for, so we'll quit with that one. What's interesting is the strong nuclear force is dominant at nuclei. Electromagnetic forces are dominant at our size scales. They're responsible for solids like this, as well as for the light you see out there. And electricity and various other things are related to the electromagnetic force. The weak nuclear force is somewhat obscure, relates to certain reactions, but we'll come back to it in a moment. And gravity, of course, is dominant at astronomical distances. The reason why gravity dominates at astronomical distances is that although it's much weaker in all of these, it's a long-range force. Inverse square, it falls off inversely as the square of the distance, whereas the weak and strong nuclear forces fall off much more rapidly than that. Electromagnetic falls off at exactly that same rate, but it's got a cancellation ability. Gravity consists of mass, all positive, you like, all attractive, whereas the electromagnetic force is operated by what we call charges. There are two kinds, plus and minus, and a plus and a plus repel, whereas a plus and a plus in gravity attract, and a minus and a minus repel, but a plus and a minus attract, so it tends to attract unlikes and cancel out the force, and that allows in gravity to dominate. I point out several important balances here that give us the right kind of universe, a balance between gravity and the expansion of cosmos, a balance such that the strong nuclear force falls in just the right range to allow the kind of range of elements we've got, a balance with the weak nuclear force that allows old stars to explode and scatter heavy elements out in the universe. So we've got heavy elements in the universe somewhere else besides inside old stars, where they'd not be much value in making living things. Unstable, that is, they diverge from that critical line as time goes on. And yet we are very near that critical line even today. There's arguments over whether the universe is one that will stop expanding and start to fall back on itself, or whether it's one that will keep expanding forever. I think the evidence favors the expanding forever, but many people in wanting to have an oscillating universe would like to have one to fall back on. So it's within a factor 10 on one side or the other in any case. And because of this diverging nature of the solutions, that means that the balance between gravity and the cosmic expansion at 10 to the minus 43rd seconds, right after the Big Bang, would have to be equal to one another to one part in 10 to the 65. Very, very fine-tuned. Strong enough fine-tuning that some people have assumed, well, it must have been exactly equal, and have tried to make cosmologies in which it's exactly equal. At the moment, there's some problems with those cosmologies, but we're not going to wander into that right here. Here's a very fine-tuning. The balance between gravity and the expansion of the universe would have to be actually one part in 1060 for the universe to last so long as this. If it had been a little bit above the line, so that there was more expansion than gravity above the critical line, the universe would have expanded so rapidly, with just a couple parts in 10 to the 60, it would have expanded so rapidly that galaxies would not have formed. If it had been a little bit below the line by a couple parts in 10 to the 60, the universe would have lasted a billion years, or 1,000 years, or 50 seconds, or such, depending on how much further you go down. So a very nice balance there, reducing the universe lasting anything like the kind of times we're talking. Another rather interesting feature is the strength of the strong nuclear force. The strong nuclear force holds atomic nuclei together. And so the question of how strong it is a measure of what elements are stable. We have maybe 100, 150 elements in their isotopes that are stable out of thousands and millions, you can imagine. And many of those four have some very crucial features in the whole question of life. Carbon, obviously, is one of these. I point out that if the strong nuclear force were 50% weaker, that sounds pretty substantial, large amount, and it is, not even iron and carbon would be stable. Iron is the most stable of the existing particular things, because the repulsion of the positive charge of the nuclei of the protons would split the thing up if you went down even by a factor of 50%. Now, 50% sounds like a large amount, but notice the size of the strong nuclear reaction against the size of gravity. We're talking of 40 orders of magnitude. And now we're talking about only 50%, which is 1/20th of an order of magnitude. There's not much change there that we're talking about. And yet that little bit would make not even iron and carbon stable. If we're just 5% weaker, deuterium would be unstable, the heavy hydrogen, a proton and a neutron in one nucleus instead of just a proton, and deuterium is rather crucial in the energy cycle of a star, and if it was unstable, then stars wouldn't work. Okay. On the other hand, if it were 5% stronger, another thing that is not stable today would be stable, a diproton would be stable. Protons form a nucleus, and if the diproton is stable, then the nuclear reaction of stars could go by the strong interaction rather than the weak interaction. You'd go millions of times faster, and stars would be supernovas all the time, sort of. Again, we'd have a rather disastrous situation, using up the fuel in just thousands of years instead of billions of years. So that's rather crucial. Strength of the weak nuclear force has to be just right. The weak nuclear force does a number of rather obscure things, but one thing it does is it's involved in the decay of a neutrino coming out of a reaction. So it's involved in some of the nuclear reactions inside stars that produce neutrinos, involved in what we call beta decay and such. Neutrinos are quite important in dispersing heavy elements into space. What happens is that a star, as the inside collapses, it shoots out all these neutrinos. Neutrinos go through enormous amounts of matter as though we're transparent. Neutrinos are going through us right now. They're going through the hole. They're not only going through us from this direction, they're going through us from this direction, coming up from the universe below our feet and all the way through the Earth and coming through. And yet, they do have slight interaction with material around them. The nuclear force being what it is, on an explosion of a star like this, they grab hold of some of the outer layers of the star and they scatter it over the whole neighboring part of the universe, and therefore provide heavier elements for the formation of newer stars. If the force were much weaker, the the neutrinos would just go shooting by when the inner part really starts throwing out these neutrinos, and they wouldn't pull the outer parts with them, so you wouldn't get an exploding star. On the other hand, if the weak interaction were much stronger than it is, they would be held up by this outer material. As they come out, they just get trapped by this outer material. This sort of balance in between the two allows stars to explode and scatter the heavier elements around. So that's a third balance. Don't have any numbers for how much weaker, how much stronger. Lastly, the balance of positive and negative charges in the universe is rather apparent. I think it's something we take for granted that out in astronomical phenomena, the electromagnetic force is only significant on small size scales. It doesn't control the behavior of stars or the movement of planets around stars or the movement of stars through galaxies, that sort of thing. And yet, the strength of the electromagnetic force is 10 to the 37 times larger than the strength of the gravity. And so ask why it isn't important out there when, in fact, both of them fall off at inverse square distance. The reason is that the number of positive and negative charges cancel out to an accuracy substantially greater than 1 part in 10 to the 37. Well, there must be some property of the universe that causes exactly equal numbers of positive and negative charges to be produced. But as far as we know, there isn't. As far as we know, the number of protons in the universe is a question of a very small number, larger number of protons than antiprotons at the time early in the history of the universe when temperatures were so high that you had both protons and antiprotons flying around and annihilating one another and being reproduced, etc. When the temperature of the universe dropped below the temperature at which collisions could produce pairs of protons and neutrons, that is when the temperature dropped below energy equal to 2 times the mass of the proton times C squared, you stopped producing proton-antiproton pairs. And then when they all annihilated each other, there turned out to be a very small excess of protons. Much later in the history of the universe, the temperature drops below that of the mass of so that the energy is equal to 2 times the mass of the electron times the speed of light squared. And that temperature is about 2,000, a factor about 2,000 smaller, universe a factor about 2,000 bigger at that point. And you have the annihilation of positrons, that is positive electrons and electrons, and they produce an excess of electrons. And lo and behold, that number of electrons is equal to that number of protons to 1 part in 10 to the 37. Very strange. And yet, if you don't get that kind of balance, then electromagnetism is a dominant force in astronomical things. And that throws you back to the question of how could the universe survive so long? And here, this critical balance between electromagnetic force and gravity, between the gravity and expansion, if you've got to throw in electromagnetism at another one on top of that. That's it. These things, and many others like them, suggest to naive-type people like me, a designer, somebody put all this together. And this sort of thing has become apparent in the last 10 years. The first place I ran across much of it is this work by Paul C.W. Davies, The Accidental Universe, written when the fellow was an atheist, quite clearly, from several remarks, not only in that book, but a couple of books later, particularly God and the New Physics, I believe, is his later book. He's still pretty atheistic in that book. But lo and behold, just a book or two ago, he's beginning to look rather theistic. Do I have that book in here? I do not have that book in here. That book is... I'll think of it eventually, but I don't have it written down. Anyway, he definitely has moved over somewhat. There have been some very strenuous attempts to avoid a designer to explain all of these phenomena, and I list them under 4 hypotheses that we've got to deal with very quickly. The weak anthropic principle, the strong anthropic principle, the many worlds hypothesis, and the oscillating universe hypothesis. The weak anthropic principle is this. All of these things fitting together is an accident. Astronomically unlikely accident. But if they didn't all fit together, we wouldn't be here. And if we weren't here, we wouldn't observe it. And so a universe in which we observe these things, that's because if we couldn't observe these things, we wouldn't be here. Okay? Just an accident of observation. If all these things didn't fit together, there'd be no life and therefore no intelligent life. But if there were no intelligent life, there'd be no observers. So wherever there are observers, everything must fit together like this or something similar to this. And therefore, here we are. Well, it's sort of an explanation, but it's not really an explanation. It's like saying, if my parents hadn't met, I wouldn't be here. Well, that's true. It's true. But it's not an explanation of how your parents met. Okay? And it's not exactly an explanation of why you're here, although it certainly has something. I pick a wilder example here. This was suggested by someone else. Paul says, if 1,000 men in this firing squad hadn't missed me, I wouldn't be here to tell you. That's true. But that doesn't explain why 1,000 men who are competent shots missed you. So it's a trivial explanation in some sense and doesn't really get to the heart of the question. And it certainly postulates that we live in something that's astronomically unlikely, but gives no explanation why it's astronomical, why something astronomically unlikely happened. There's therefore been considerable dissatisfaction with the weak anthropic principle, and three other attempts that I know of to get around it. One's called a strong anthropic principle, the idea that future events cause past events. Mankind coming to exist somehow causes the conditions that occur needed to bring them to existence. I've not got time and time we've got to look at that. It sounds to me either occult on the one hand, the universe is some kind of being seeking to come to be or something, getting to design it very quickly over in that direction, or it's self-contradictory, kind of the idea that events up here in the future can send causal forces back into the past to make themselves happen. It brings us into the time machine paradox, which we had 20 minutes more. I'd love to give a little illustration of my story, how to get rich if you can design a time machine without even letting any other people in on it or having a patent book. But let's wait on that. Another suggestion has been the many-worlds hypothesis. In quantum mechanics, there's been great puzzlement on why, if the universe is really sort of a random thing, such as the Heisenberg model of quantum mechanics suggests, why it is that things ever happen. Why it is that this electron, which is really a wave and passing through these two slits, etc., why it ever gets absorbed at any particular place over here on the other side, instead of kind of just being staying over there as a wave in some way. It's called the collapse of the wave function. And Hugh Everett suggests, in fact, every possible thing that can happen to this electron as it passes through these two slits and comes to be absorbed over here does happen. But each possibility makes a new universe. The universe is continually splitting into almost infinitely many possibilities that each of one of them is one way in which these results could come out. And so Hugh Everett then says in regard to this problem here, we happen to live in one of the very rare universes in which everything works out right that observes. There are infinite number of universes splitting infinitely rapidly into infinitely more universes every moment. And we happen to live in the one, and there might be a few others, one that all of these things work with. I can let you think about that. That's hard to swallow, okay? The oscillating universe hypothesis of John Wheeler is basically an attempt to do the same thing successively. We live in the only universe there is right at the moment. But there's been infinitely many universes. Every oscillation you get a different kind of universe. We happen to be in the one that everything works out right for life. But maybe none of the others ever have. Maybe none of the others ever will. We're in the one that does. There are problems with that. There are problems with the oscillating universe hypothesis in general, whether a universe can bounce, whether it can do so infinitely without running down and such. Again, not time to discuss that. Every one of these alternatives makes some very strong assumptions regarding the nature of unseen reality without any positive evidence. Now, Christians make very strong assumptions regarding the nature of unseen reality. We believe there's an infinite God out there who's a designer, etc. Notice we have, however, some rather helpful things here. A designer can explain why all these things fit together. It can explain how all of the design we seem to see in animate nature will work if the evolutionary theory won't work, as it appears also. And there is some positive evidence for God besides those two lines. That is, God himself has communicated. And so I suggest there's historical evidence for God's intervention in the creation of the nation Israel at Sinai, in the events surrounding the ministry of Jesus, the impact and the changes in lives that trusting in Jesus have made, the whole area of fulfilled prophecy, etc. It really talks of evidence for the existence of God in the Bible, not just a hypothesis. Whereas the many worlds, the oscillating universe, the strong anthropic principle, are all hypotheses. I try to suggest here that inanimate design itself is a powerful evidence that points towards a designer and not merely a random universe that makes no sense.